Hi, this is Paula Moreau, and welcome to the Tales from the South podcast.
Handle on my life. Handle on my life.
How's everybody doing tonight? So how about tonight's music by Amy Garland? Y'all like Amy? Amy Garland is one of the best singer-songwriters in the Mid-South. Her new record, Hang a Light, contains some of her finest songs to date and is getting considerable amount of radio play. More can be heard at ReverbNation.com. All right, well, welcome to Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, and to another edition of Tales from the South, where Southerners bring their own true stories to life. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, both right here in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And I'm your host, Paula Martin Morrell. On my right here, strumming his 1931 National Resonator, is blues guitarist Mark Simpson. Little Rock native Mark Simpson was, among other things, a featured house guitarist at the late Junior Kimbrough's Juke Joint in Tullahoma, Mississippi. Mark wrote our theme music and plays for us live each week. And how about our set back here? Y'all like our set? Each show we feature an artist, and tonight's featured artist is Little Rock painter Mara Weir. And our featured piece is this piece right over here entitled Onions, which is for sale. Our listeners can find out more about this piece and Mara at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. All right, are y'all ready for some Southern-style storytelling? Tonight, our stories all center around fate and the hand our writers are dealt. All stories are true and told by the Southerners who live them. Later tonight, Amy Gray Light's fate lies in a phone call, and we'll end the night with Don Strite, a prize, and a revelation. But let's start the night with Mary Elaine Lester as her trip turns into more than just a series of coincidences in Joan of Arc.
The first woman at the sign-in table looks up after finding my name on the list to board the chartered bus to Alice Walton's Crystal Bridges Museum in Northwest Arkansas. I love that necklace! Every time I wear this pearl and silver rope necklace, people notice, even at 7:45 a.m. Where'd you get it? The second woman at the table asks. Before I can answer the familiar question, I unexpectedly hear, I made the necklace. I spin around and see the actual creator of this piece of art. The serendipity snaps me awake as I remember our conversation a few months earlier. Every necklace is different. She was seated next to her handmade treasures. I make some with precious stones, some with pearls. The silver has the tensile strength to be crocheted. She was knitting silver. I had to have one of those masterpieces. I shop at Goodwill and love a bargain, but when I see something precious, I find the money. That day, destiny would not let me leave without my own pearl of great price. And now the artist stands behind me in the line on our way to one of the premier art museums in the country. Artists rarely hear about the impact of their art. The silver necklace has brought me so much delight, I am thrilled to make sure the maker receives her due praise. Moments later, I step onto the bus. Crystal Bridges will have to be out of this world to be more memorable. As I search for my seat, I realize I'm the last one on the bus. I spy the only seat remaining, second row by the door. The only double seat with no occupant. Just perfect now and later for my after-art musings. People and their stories never fail to fascinate me. Even though I want to view the art all by myself and may not say a word on the way back, my curiosity has me turn around and introduce myself to the couple in the seat directly behind mine. I immediately notice the wife's yellow cap. Looks like an Amish cap, but the Amish don't wear yellow. My mind was trying to find a place for the incongruity. I'm Joan, and this is my husband, Alan. I see that the cap matches her outfit, and already I am amazed by her courage. Cancer. I can't even face the reality. How can she? I wonder about her journeys down the road less traveled, but wait for Joan to tell her story. Yesterday was my birthday, and Alan and I celebrated our 53rd wedding anniversary. I realize Joan is celebrating life in the face of death. Whatever the risk to my agenda, I am all in. So, Alan, are you the romantic in the family? I asked to draw him into the conversation. Alan shrugs. Yes, with a twinkle in his eye as he straightens the blanket around Joan. I know true love when I see it, and I want to know their secret. I learn Alan and Joan are both transplants from upstate New York. They now live on 25 acres of Arkansas country. Two children also left New York and live on both sides of their property. Not only had Joan and Alan fallen in love with each other, they had fallen in love with Arkansas. I also learned Joan and I both love flowers. In upstate New York, she tells me, they protect rhododendrons. I wanted Joan to be protected. Joan includes the love of her life in the conversation. Alan is a great photographer. What's your favorite farm picture, Alan? I hope this is the question that will help me know him better. Well, I don't take that many pictures anymore. The equipment is just too hard to carry around, and I'm not changing to digital. He is cross-armed and comfortable with that decision. I understand, I say. I still have VHS tapes and cassettes at home. I am sure she wants to forget about cancer for a day, but somehow Joan begins to tell me about her ordeal. She's been battling multiple myeloma for the past year. Her sister came from California to help her through 5 chemo treatments. And now Joan has gotten a good report. She and Alan are meeting friends for lunch at Crystal Bridges. What's your secret for being married 53 years? I still want to know. We like each other and we respect each other, Joan says. She doesn't say love. Joan reveals more details about her cancer battle. She's been treated at UAMS in Little Rock. I remember making friends with a couple from Germany at Barnes & Noble in Little Rock. Hans and Eva Hess sold their house to come to America so that Hans could be treated a second time by Dr. Barlogi, coincidentally, Joan's doctor. I met Dr. Barlogi with Hans and Eva at dinner one night. Trying to encourage Joan, I shared that the medical center had given me my life back after I had brain surgery to correct a rare neurological condition that caused spasms on the left side of my face. I often think life is not the expected A story, but rather the unexpected B story, the subplot we haven't written and rehearsed in our head. Crystal Bridges is anticlimactic because of the journey my heart has already taken. Besides, it is Saturday and too many people are at the museum for my liking. It feels more like Disneyland, shoulder to shoulder, waiting for your turn. The museum itself and the art is incredible, though. Portraits of George Washington and Rosie the Riveter, Marilyn Monroe, landscapes, hummingbirds, a picture of peaches lush enough to eat. I see Joan and Alan in the museum and take their picture. Alan isn't smiling in the first one. I say, "Remember, Alan, you're the romantic." He smiles, and I take another picture. Joan is standing at the elevator when I realize her dress is graced with flowers. I spy her coordinating green jade necklace. She has dressed up for the occasion and taken time to accessorize. Back to life. I board the bus 4 hours after stepping off of it. I don't want to tire Joan after the long day. Few words are spoken on the way back home. She does tell me about an important part of her life. I used to be a nurse in New York at Columbia Presbyterian. Ironically, she's on the other side now. I question whether I should share my own health struggles, but Joan's transparency gives me permission. I had whooping cough last year. I'm still not 100%, so I'm going to see a pulmonologist at the med center. Joan offers, "I think seeing a pulmonologist is a good plan. You may need an inhaler to reduce the inflammation." Amazingly, the woman in the yellow cap has compassion to spare for me. I settle back into my seat and watch the scenery change. And I watch the scenery change, the mountains to hills. I touch my necklace, grateful for the opportunity to thank the artist personally for such a gift. I send up a thank you to all the artists whose works touched my heart at the museum. And I send up gratitude for my new friend, her life. I will never again see Crystal Bridges without seeing Joan of Arc. What an unforgettable picture she left on display in my gallery.
Mary Elaine Lester, a career mathematics instructor reaching Arkansas through distance learning, has found a surprising passion for writing and performing. Mary dedicates this story to Joan, whose continuing courage inspires her to live fully. Next, Amy Gray Light doesn't know it, but her fate has been sealed before she even picks up the phone in A Live Connection.
By 1989, I had been happily divorced 2 years, having weathered a few semi-relationships that failed to get off the ground for various reasons, and several disastrous first dates. The closest I had come to a serious boyfriend was an architect who lived in New York. Since I lived in Virginia and worked in D.C. at the time, the distance between us was perfect. But this relationship also fizzled out. I was fine with that. I was happy with my work and enjoyed hanging out with my friends, my family, and my cat. So I was unprepared for an encounter with destiny when my editor-in-chief tossed a project on my desk with the command to interview this person. As the associate editor of an architecture magazine, I was responsible for writing features on new projects, news developments, and products. This particular design project, soon to open in Austin, Texas, was a combination piano pool hall. Not many of those around, I hazard to guess. Eric's Pool Hall, as it was called, was executed with whimsy and flair, and I looked forward to talking to the imaginative and witty architect responsible. I picked up the phone. Usually, when an editor from an architecture magazine is on the line explaining the nature of the call, you can hear the excitement in their voice when they find out they are about to be published. The first words out of this guy's mouth, however, sounded like a sneer. "What'd you do? Pick that out of the round file?" he replied flatly. Feeling chastened and not a little awkward and offended, I quickly replied with as much starch in my voice as I could muster that I could tell he wasn't interested, thanked him for his time, and hung up. As I sat there wondering what to tell my editor, the phone rang. It was Mr. Surly Guy, all apologetic and charming. He explained he had been caught up short. He had tried to retrieve the project slides a year ago and had been told by the art department that they had lost them. He had been annoyed. As he made his apologies, I couldn't help but note how warm and masculine his voice sounded over the telephone. We agreed to set up a phone interview the following day. Typically, my interviews are a mix of handwritten notes and a tape recorder used as a backup and safety measure. As I had hoped, the interview was a lot of fun, more so than usual, in fact. As I replayed the tape, I was struck by the realization that there was a lot of 50-50 spread of business and all ha-ha-ha personal information flying back and forth. We had gotten pretty flirty. Over the next 2 weeks, while I worked on the piece and chose slides for the layout, I was always pleasantly surprised when I had a reason to call him up, to confirm a fact or ask about a detail. I couldn't deny I called him more than I usually did a designer when writing up a project. Finally, the article was finished. I was satisfied with it, knowing he would also be pleased with the end result. A bit regretfully, I called for the last time to thank him for his time and input and let him know when the feature would be published. I made sure to get his address to send a complimentary copy. The following day, the phone rang. "Hey, kid, I just missed talking to you," he said. As much as I enjoyed it, too, it was obvious I couldn't have a personal conversation at work. The next thing I know, he has my home phone. It becomes a habit for him to call around 10 o'clock at night. Both of us are night owls, and we'd stay on the line for an hour at a time. The nightly routine was one that I looked forward to. After 4 weeks, he begins to broach the subject of meeting in person. I brushed it off each time. He lived in Maryland, more than an hour away from D.C. But truthfully, I was enjoying my new telephone buddy, and I didn't want to jeopardize our friendship. I was afraid the bubble might burst if he was short, fat, or bald. Enjoying my flirt fantasy, I continued to put him off. After a few more weeks, he finally told me he was driving down that Saturday to take me to lunch. "I can't. I have to work," I quickly countered. "You have to eat. I'll meet you in the lobby at noon," he said in a voice that broached no further argument. After brief descriptions, "I'm tall and dark-haired. I'm tall with auburn hair," we hung up for the night. That Saturday, as the noon hour approached, I was nervous as I reluctantly sat on a bench in the lobby, awaiting my fate for the next hour, or so I thought. Soon, a very tall, good-looking, slender man with shoulder-length wavy hair pushed his way through the lobby doors. My heart did an actual flip-flop as these thoughts bubbled in my head. "Crap, I don't want to get married again." Many years later, as we were having lunch with a friend, she asked us how we had met. As I told her the story with my now husband listening beside me, I laughed, since I had never told him my first reaction to our meeting. "You don't know the whole story," he said with a chuckle. Apparently, when we hung up from my initial interview request, he had called my boss. "What's the matter, Dawn? Am I slipping? You were a senior editor, have always reviewed my work before. Today, I just got a call from some associate editor." "You want to meet this girl," my editor-in-chief replied. "Don't you have a restaurant you designed up there somewhere? You should take her out to lunch." "What? I've never had to take my editor out to lunch before," now hubby protested. "You aren't listening to me," my editor replied. "You need to meet this girl." Dawn Canty, my crusty old editor-in-chief, a romantic, and I never knew it. How I wished I had learned the whole story before he died. I would have written to thank him for steering me into a relationship with the love of my life and into a very happy marriage, now in its 23rd year.
Amy Gray Light's passions include writing, reading, animals, classic movies, and eating really excellent dark chocolate. A professional writer, Amy frequently writes about living with a rare cancer and other personal essays, including living on their Mustang Sanctuary, Wing Spur, on Wine Mountain in Arkansas. In our final story of the night, Don Strite discovers that fate sometimes has many faces in A Soul's Delight.
My mother spoke of grace with a quiet reverence, as if it were fragile as a soap bubble. Speaking too forcefully about it would make it disappear into thin air. Grace was not a word to be shouted anyway. My mother's belief was couched in doctrine. She quoted the book definition. It's a gift of kindness or good fortune, given not because you deserve it, but because you need it. I needed it. There was an aura of doom that enveloped our home, most strikingly at night, most nights. My father drank. In the middle of the night, he would waken us, shouting angry feelings he didn't dare express in the light of day, ranting about politicians who abuse their power, ranting at my mother. This was uncharacteristic of my father when he was sober. He was a kind and generous man. To conceal those tumultuous episodes, a dictum was issued: what happens inside our home shall not be revealed outside our home. Now, I know it's normal for children to think they are somehow accountable for what their family members do, to feel pride when things are going well and embarrassment when they're not. In this way, I was perfectly normal. But among my peers, I never quite felt normal. Maybe it would have been different if I could have accepted the peculiarities of our home life, like Marilyn Munster, who felt no need to conceal her ghoulish family's true nature. But when you're told to shroud your truth in secrecy, you can't help but feel like a misfit. Even within my extended family, upstanding citizens like attorneys, even a judge, I felt uncomfortable. But my Uncle Bernie was different. Everything about Uncle Bernie was big. He was 300 pounds and 6 feet tall, like a sumo wrestler, only taller. He loved life with a passion. Even the word my cousin used to describe him was big: magnanimous. The fact that he owned two of the three movie theaters in town was testimony to his desire that he loved to make people happy. He had a gift for knowing how to entertain. Every Saturday morning of every summer I can remember, he offered a summer Saturday extravaganza. My sister and I both went to it. She met her friends there, and I met mine. Everything about the morning was bigger and more exciting than going to the theater any other day of the week. The popcorn bulged inside large brown bags like oversized duffel bags, as high as Uncle Bernie's chest. One of my friends said it looked like the usual bags had been hit by gamma rays, and it was all free. The show was bigger, too. At least three cartoons before the main feature, and at least one afterwards. But the most exciting part of the morning was the drawing. Upon entering the theater, we were instructed to drop our ticket stubs into the large metal box at the entrance. Some of us even watched as the person behind us pushed his ticket in just to be sure that ours made it all the way inside. I think most of us gripped our half of the ticket stub in our sweaty hands as if it might jump out of our pockets onto the darkened floor, the land of lost opportunities. One Saturday morning when I was 10, Uncle Bernie came outside to greet us as we entered the theater. Now, he usually stood on the stage waiting for everyone to be seated, but on that morning, he stood next to the metal box. As I approached the entrance to the theater with my ticket, he took a step between the box and me. "Let me see that winning ticket, Donnie." Then he took it, stuck it in his pocket, patted me on the back, and said, "Good luck." I remember thinking, yeah, we both know I'm only here for the movies. Because of the misfortunes occurring in my family, I knew that good luck was what happened to other people. Families like mine were not winners. At best, my odds that day were 400 to 1 to win that prize. Now, that morning was the usual popcorn throwing, right up and down the aisle fun. After the last cartoon, as the lights in the theater got brighter, Uncle Bernie approached from the right side of the stage with the metal box tucked under his arm. Two or three ushers carried a large cardboard box up to the stage. It was obviously very heavy because they stopped a couple of times to get a better grip on the box. The prizes were always high-priced items, too. Bicycles, stereo phonographs, sporting equipment. Uncle Bernie grabbed the microphone from its stand and quieted the screaming kids, pushing down the air with both hands. He pulled one ticket from the box, paused, and looked at it again, and then he called my number. I had already turned my attention away, convinced mine would not be called. I didn't realize I had won until the boy next to me snatched the ticket from my hand and jabbed me in the stomach. By that time, the ushers had stripped away the cardboard and were starting to hold a stereo system with detachable speakers. Detachable speakers. Detachable speakers meant it really would have stereo sound. That can't be, I thought. My family doesn't win, but I did win. And in that instant, I felt like the world around me had changed the rules about what our family deserved. A few years ago, my sister and I got to talking about that fateful day. Oh, yeah, she said, that was great when Uncle Bernie rigged the drawing, so you won that stereo. My pause on the end of the phone prompted my sister to ask, are you still there? 40 years had passed, and I never knew. He did what? I asked. You mean he cheated? Now it was her turn to be amazed. Yeah, you didn't know that? How could I have known that, Susie? She said, don't you remember that he didn't let you put your ticket in the box? He took it out of your hand and stuck it in his pocket. Mom thinks he copied your ticket number and read your number instead of the number on the ticket he actually drew out. When I think about it, I can remember that he asked me to hand him my ticket. How much clearer could that have been? He never handled anyone's ticket. He just pointed to the box. That day, the odds against me weren't 400 to 1 after all. They were much, much greater. What are the odds of having an uncle who owns a movie theater, knows about the turmoil in your home, and decides to make you the winner of a chance drawing? Uncle Bernie knew I needed to feel like a winner, but I don't think he could ever know how much his gift meant. He made me believe for the first time that good things could happen for me just like they did for others. He inspired hope for more good fortune. Now, it's true that the stereo was a premium prize, but the real prize was grace. As a kid, I wanted to see what grace looked like. I thought maybe it flowed from some sort of celestial dispenser and only holy people were the vendors. But even a small town theater owner who uses his power with compassion is a person of grace. That day, Uncle Bernie gave grace a face. What better way to entertain a soul than to offer it hope?
Don Stride is a psychotherapist and workshop presenter in Little Rock. He loves to write tales about how his family faces life with courage, wit, and grace. So how about our stories and storytellers tonight? Thank you to all of our writers, thank you to our live audience, and thank you to ULR Public Radio. Tales from the South is presented by the Argenta Arts Foundation and Temenos Publishing Company, and our official media sponsor is AY Magazine, Arkansas's leading lifestyle publication at aymag.com. Additional support provided by William F. Lehman Public Library, the North Little Rock Visitors Bureau, the Writers Colony at Derry Hollow, and the Oxford American, the Southern Magazine of Good Writing. You can find us on Facebook, Twitter, iTunes, YouTube, and Stitcher Smart Radio, and you can download and listen to our podcast on our website. More can be found at talesfromthesouth.com. Have a great night, and we'll see you next week at Starving Artist Cafe in the Argenta Arts District of North Little Rock, Arkansas, for another edition of Tales from the South. Good night, everybody.
Here's a song I wrote on my, which album was this? This is on the second album, I guess, called Angora, and the name of the song is called Chicken Picking. I don't know why we called it chicken picking, except that Nick's doing a little chicken picking on it. There's nothing to do with poultry in this song. Listening to what you are saying, I'm thinking that you've seen better days. You're healing from the stones this world's thrown you, and you seem so blue. You seem so blue. Sitting at this bar all alone, just wishing you had someone to call your own. But the backhand of little looks done slapped you across the cheek. And why does it still seem so bittersweet? Hard as it is, and hard as it gets, hard as you make it, hard as you live it, hard as the icy wind that breaks the limbs out. Trees with just a breeze, just a breeze. Your arms outstretched, open wide. No, no one could ever say you didn't try. And I think I know how that heartache feels. It comes on in the dead of the night and leaves in an automobile. Hard as it is, and hard as you make it, hard as you live it, hard as the icy wind that breaks the limbs out. Trees were just a breeze, just a breeze, yeah. Now the lights have gone down on this town. There ain't nowhere to go, ain't no one around. I think I'll take you home and sing your heart to sleep. No, no one could ever take you all that deep. Hard as it is, and hard as you make it, hard as you let it, hard as the icy wind that breaks the limbs out. Trees were just a breeze, just a breeze, yeah.
brighter accommodations provided by Robin Wood Bed and Breakfast. More at robinwoodbnb.com. Experience Tales in person as a member of our live audience. Schedule and ticket information can be found at our website, talesfromthesouth.com. Thanks for helping keep the art of Southern style storytelling alive. And we'll see you next week, either on this station or at Starving Artist Cafe, for another edition of Tales from the South.